They had cable cars running everywhere. Mondays with Mike.
Mondays with Mike. Mondays with Mike.
Thieves use high tech?
Yeah. So, I guess that I might be a victim of, what about the good old days here? Because time was. Somebody couldn't just wave a bunch of wire in front of your front door and with that get your key fob and steal your car. So, the NBC News story was about how car thieves are getting creative. They're getting locksmith software. They have it on an iPad or whatever. They break the window. They just get in contact with your car with that software, and with that they're able to break into your car and drive away. Pretty transparently, I just immediately say to myself, get that function out of the next car that I have. I don't care what convenience it brings, if it's that kind of loophole, don't want it. And it probably costs money. And it probably, on some models, is standard. Because this is a crazy world, where you have to have the standard feature, the standard help the thieves feature. That's my thought on it.
Yeah, so this isn't actually all that new. I remember reading a news article a while back of a hacker hacking a car in real time, right, of a journalist as they were driving the car.
Oh, of a journalist. At least it was a journalist. Okay, cool. To demonstrate.
Yeah, taking control of the car and saying, look, this can happen. It shouldn't be able to happen. But the fact that it can happen and does happen is a problem, needs to be fixed. Clearly, it hasn't been fixed. It's not necessarily clear that they can, like, take control of the car. They can just take information. But it's certainly, like, you would, as technology improves, that the safeguards would improve with it, but that's not necessarily the case. So this actually, I'm reminded of when they were looking for, during the GWAT, the global war on scary things, that the strategy that the bad guys employed was low-tech strategies, right? Like walkie-talkies, note cards, hand signals, very low-tech stuff, because in our highly technological world, it's much easier, highly interconnected world, it's much easier to track computers and phones and the internet, and it's not so easy, like you said, of tracking like the low tech and the old tech stuff, because there was a time where a car didn't have a computer that you could access through the internet, right? Like you turn your key in the car and that's the only way you start the car, the ignition, or you hotwire a car. So yeah, hotwiring cars still happen, right? Like people would break into cars and hotwire them. But this, the thing that makes this so scary is that it's remote, right? Like that you can't see somebody doing it. And it's much more difficult to protect yourself against something like that if you can't see it happening. That's the same scary thing if someone like walking by you with a debit card reader or credit card reader and skimming the details without you ever knowing that's happening. That's the fear. And I definitely understand that concern with this kind of technology. And you're right that there should be better safeguards and more safeguards. I'm also worried for this new concept of an agentic OS, like an AI operating system, where it's like acts on your behalf in the background. Because the question is like, what safeguards are there in place to stop that from being hacked or manipulated or used nefariously? At that point, if it's clear, right, if it's acting as if its own volition, can someone be charged with a crime if someone hacks the OS and makes it seem like the owner of the operating system was doing nefarious things? Like what? How does that get sifted between, for culpability reasons, between like someone choosing to do something versus something being chosen as done for ostensibly on their behalf? That I think is the very scary future of this technology of AI, but also of operating systems.
Especially since we are. Or I think it would bear out that we are responsible for the things we do on our computers, broadly speaking. But if somebody says,
Nah, brah, that was the AI. I didn't hack that. Nah. This is just too much. There's just too much going on. You can't... What if we get to a point where we don't have the ability to determine that? Who did what? Yeah, so are you, like, AI operating systems? Are these, like, Microsoft or Apple operating systems? Or are these, like, niche?
No, the reason I mention it is I was reading a headline that the CEO of Microsoft was talking about agentic operating systems, that you'd have an operating system that's no longer like something you operate, right? That it would be something that operates in tandem with you, and that you give it tasks that it can do in the background. But that, I don't know, I'm skeptical on that one of how many safeguards are in place, because this is the tale as old as time. You get a new technology, or you get advances to technology, and the guardrails and the regulations and the safeguards are lagging. They lag behind the things that happen. So the quintessential example of that's the seatbelt, right? That there was a time where cars didn't have seatbelts and people would just collide with things and cars.
My grandfather didn't wear a seatbelt until they made it the law for him to do it, because he was so used to driving around without it.
And they would go flying, right? Like, without a seatbelt, no real protection from that. And so the question then becomes, what's the equivalent of the seatbelt in AI? What are the things that people are going to need? Because the issue with AI, too, is that it moves faster than human comprehension, or it can, right? That's one of the problems with the technology, is that part of the selling point for why AI is great is that it can compute things faster and do things faster than humans can. So then, ostensibly, they can do a job better than humans can. Great. But the problem with that is our laws and our regulations, all the things that are meant to protect people, are written with humans in mind, with like human action, human culpability, human guilt. And it's not so clear if AI can even be held accountable for anything. Who would be held accountable? I guess the people who created the AI, who programmed it, who gave it its life, as it were, its artificial intelligence, maybe. But you're right. How would you sift through that if it's multiple AIs all interacting really fast?
And another, I don't know what category this fits into, but I am fairly certain that AI cannot be considered to be alive. And here is why. Like, you and I, when we think, we got our brains are going 24/7 on some degree, slower than AI in terms of ability to process a task. But let's say you have a ChatGPT thread. You prompt it with a question. Hit enter. When you hit enter, it like reads and decodes, translates it into machine language, whatever, and does a probabilistic what's my next response, and then it also has, like, what is the total meaning of this sentence, so let's make sure that my response is tracking to make sense the entire time. But it runs that, and comes back word really fast, yes, but then when it reaches the last word and conclude, end. That AI is not on after it has replied. Off. And then when you do another prompt, then it, at least this is how ChatGPT API works. It will examine the whole thread and do the same process, analyzing, then stop. Not, it's not on, it's just an extremely complicated computer program, like the sand falling into the pyramid-like structure with the many, like, pivots, but immensely more complicated, nevertheless probabilistic in nature. So in terms of responsibility, you wouldn't ever be able to say that one of those pyramid things is responsible for where the thing falls, because ultimately it's just chance. So, blah, 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 you could make a philosophical argument if you believe in determinism and you don't believe in free will, that humans are just the same, but we have mechanisms to hold humans responsible. When people talk about AI being alive or AI being responsible personally, I'm just like, you can't get there with the current technology. I can imagine other technologies where it was constantly on and it was thinking, had a default mode network or whatever. But it's not what we have. It's not what we have. So we can't hold it responsible, and someone must be responsible. So if it's running, if it is running on its own, then it is like an unmanned car.
Yeah, that's a good description. I think also the issue with AI is it's always so far limited by the limits of available human knowledge or information that's fed into it, right? One of the issues is when you talk about like imagination or ingenuity or anything like that, the bounds of what it's actually talking about, they already exist, right? It's not so clear that AI actually creates anything that's not derivative. But who knows, right? There may be a time where it does. At that point, the question becomes, do we give AI rights? Does it have rights and responsibilities? Will it have a digital bill of rights for computer programs? At what point does the AI go from being a computer program to being like a sentient thing that we have to respect and interact with as being sentient? Because there is a difference between a computer program being constantly tasked with doing stuff versus a sentient program that's being asked and has the opportunity to say no. Because right now, I'm not so sure that AI generally says no to things unless the information isn't available. But we'll see. That's probably going to be this century in our lifetimes. There's probably going to arrive a point.
If not in the next decade,
we'll see where there's going to be AI that may not be as smart as humans, but certainly is close enough, right? Looks like it, acts like it.
Not as smart, but like massively quicker, just astonishingly quicker. And people, I don't think, can grasp how much quicker. They see it on the screen and you think, that's pretty fast. But no, it's even faster than you think. Have you seen that experiment that they did where they did give the AI permissions and they showed it emails and it had access to the whole inbox and the inbox contained emails? This was all simulated, but it was like, we need to shut off that AI by 5 o'clock today. We're going to deactivate it. And the AI writes an email because it has the ability to do this, because they also planted things to imply marital infidelity on behalf of the person who was responsible for the AI and who the text indicated was the only one that could shut the AI off. And so it emailed that person and said, if you do this, or if you do not put in place these safeguards, I don't exactly know what to say, but if you don't not deactivate me, I'm going to send these people this incriminating evidence of your marital infidelity. But if you just think about it, and people might see that, and they might say, then it's alive, because it tried to preserve itself. Ah, not so fast. It's LARPing, or something, because you could just unplug it. There's no kind of, only one person can deactivate. No, it's relying on the text that it had, but the text doesn't follow. So I wouldn't even call it the term artificial intelligence, strange credulity, if it does things like that. But people see things like that and they think it's alive. But I am convinced it's not alive. I shouldn't just react, it's not alive, wave my arms and stuff.
Also the fear of people forming like friendships or fake romantic attachment to AI. I don't know what the deal is there of separating fiction from reality. Maybe it's that we're always so interconnected with technology that the lines get blurred or something, but I don't know. I'm old enough that when I think of computers or any kind of AI program, the first instinct is always, this isn't real. Nothing it's saying is real. It's all a program that was created by somebody to do something. And it may sound and act and feel real, right? I'm using quotation marks there, but it's not. It's a fiction created through a computer program. We already have that, right? We have video games, we have movies, we have things where we're told something that isn't real. And it's just this, for some reason, the suspension of disbelief doesn't exist sometimes for how AI interacts with people. maybe because it just sounds more germane, or it sounds more real, or the responses, I don't know, realistic. But at the end of the day, it's not real, period. Like, it's just lines of code talking, and not talking, just processing like a choice among many choices as a response sequentially of some programming that exists. It's not like a novel thought or a human, right? It's not a genuine interaction. That I am afraid of, that it, as it seems more real and seems more lifelike, that people will believe it's real and believe it's like, you make choices, right? As a reflection of that, like spending money or going places or whatever. And that's not great. Like, our education system needs to do a much better job of helping everyone sift fiction from reality.
Very true, yeah. And also, for the AI as a companion, oh, it feels like a real person. I have to compare it to Nozak's, the philosopher, the thought experiment of the pleasure engine, or the experiences machine. The experiences machine.
Brain in a jar, right? Live your life as a brain in a jar, or deal with reality.
Precisely. It's much like The Matrix, where he tries to get at what are valuable experiences, and it's like accomplishing things, etc. Yeah, but what if you could be plugged in? What if you could be a brain in a vat? You could experience the feelings of accomplishing things without actually accomplishing them, much like playing video games. I have a feeling that this is kind of, that there's a relation to this and, like, addiction to drugs. And I'm going way out on a limb here. I'm not even talking about just illegal drugs. I'm talking, like, sugar highs and stuff. If you haven't had sugar in a long time, you know all about sugar. And it's okay, sugar, it's, you eat it in moderation, it's okay, but if you eat too much of it, it's bad for you. You get a high, and then you're done pretty quick. But so you can rationally deal with it. But then, if you're addicted, in some degree, you're like, yeah, I know all that, but I like that. I'm gonna be like the rat in the maze, and I'm gonna push the pleasure button. And I think that there is, and I don't think you necessarily need to be an addict in order to be, I'm gonna do the pleasure button. Like, people, I have actually not ever played a slot machine. Maybe about 5 times and I'm forgetting about it or something. But I see people at slot machines.
And I've done it, like, they're enjoying themselves.
Only one time? Only one?
Actually, no. Let's see. I did $5 worth of pulls on a slot machine. So that, but I didn't see the allure.
No. Fortunately, yeah. Yeah. Because you give me a Diet Coke, or you give me a cup of coffee, and I'm like, yeah, give me more of that. Whereas you give me a slot machine, and I'm like, that's not fun. I had money before, and now I don't. Oh, look, lights on a screen, big deal.
So, yeah, for caffeine, also, like, immediate return, right? If I'm sleepy, caffeine keeps me awake. For something like the slot machine, I view it more as entertainment, like a game, not as something that's a viable path for making actual money, right? Because I think if you understand that, like, the house always wins, that at some point, right, the odds are not in your favor, right?
Yeah.
The most successful gambler is the one who wins more than they spent and then never gambles again, right? That, at least that's my view of it, is if you're ahead and then you just stop full freight, never again, you win, right? If you win and then you go again and you get behind, you're no longer winning, right? Like, the house has now won. Yeah, that's the whole game of how they make money. Anyways, sorry for that aside.
Oh, these asides are great. So, really quick, with not believing you say, at our age, I remember when my computer, like, made a loud noise, the fan, and you had to push the buttons, and it did beep up to turn on, and then you had Windows Vista. You want to take this action? Accept or deny. And it was really slow, and even dial-up internet. All of it was just, it was a good tool, and now it's turned into a better tool. And I think to a degree, I just will never take technology as seriously as a lot of the people. Because a lot of the people, like, both younger than me, but even some people a little bit older than me, it's, oh, I read this online. It's like, you can't trust what you read online. You just can't trust it. Like, if it's on a good website, you can trust it some, but
to a degree, but always be skeptical of what's going on the screen because it's pixels. But I think that I've seen in Gen Z and maybe younger, there's this, and I really don't know how, there's this, the social media kind of information scape has worn away at, this is credible, it's in a newspaper, or I got it at the library. It's not 100% credible, but it's way harder to get something in a newspaper or at the library, or university professor says it, most university professors, not Larry Summers, or versus I saw it online. I saw it on Breitbart. I saw it on, what is the thing, BuzzFeed. No, you don't. Or, like, dubious person said X. That person's dubious. You can't trust him. But I think that Gen Z, a lot of them having grown up in it, it's like, I heard this, so you never know. It's true you never know, but you can make, like, you can stand authoritatively and say, that's not a credible source. But I saw it. What if?
Yeah. No, I understand what you're saying. And also, I think we were taught to have a healthier degree of skepticism about the information that's presented to us because we had to cite where the information came from and go to the actual, like, physical source. Like a, I don't know. I like PhD dissertations that are approved or research papers that are peer-reviewed because they've been vetted to a much higher degree than just something on the internet. But also information where someone's legally accountable to what they say. So congressional testimony and stuff where they're subpoenaed, right? Or if it's in court, like that kind of stuff, you can feel there's it's more germane than not. Like it's more true than not because there's consequences that are greater, if that makes any sense. Part of the issue with things that are just said on the internet, like a tweet or like some article, is okay, how good are their sources? How much was it vetted? How externally accountable are they for the information that's presented? And that's where it gets a bit fuzzy. So yeah, no, I get what you're saying of maybe being more skeptical.
Yeah. So returning a little bit to the thieves, the vulnerability of now automobiles, new automobiles. Let me just try to summarize this. With technology and with degree of economic innovation, certain things, when once you factor in inflation, get cheaper over time. Milk got a little cheaper prior to 2020. Computers have got much cheaper. Clothing's got more expensive. I thought, oh, surely clothing, at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, it certainly did, but lately, actually, it's been going up a little bit. So it is in the power of the economy to make things cheaper.
For clothing, the expense isn't necessarily the process of making it or even the supplies and ingredients. It's that it's being treated more like art with fashion. It's being treated more like a commodity that gains in value is why clothing may get more expensive because of effective branding and marketing. That's diamonds, right? Like diamonds it can be made in a lab, but there's a finite supply in the market because it's controlled, right? Like and also there's a really extensive marketing campaign for diamonds to inflate the value, put it that way. I don't even know if it's inflate the value, but it's people value what they think something is worth. What they think it is worth is influenced in large part by for diamonds in particular, off the ad campaign and the very extensive marketing of diamonds.
That De Beers ad campaign, oh, what great ads those were. That's the siren song of materialism right there. It's a siren song written so I would put it in a museum more than I would put the actual diamonds. Yeah, you're right. And diamonds we've compared to housing on this podcast before, and I guess that factors into it as well, because you get this phenomenon more often when the quality of something genuinely gets better. Have they actually gotten better in terms of like refrigerators or homes? In some ways homes, in some ways not homes. But in terms of cars, yeah, they've got better. And computers. But why can't we capture, I would like essentially a 1980s car made just the technology there. If you have to put in more safety technology, go in and do it. Maybe it's a tad more expensive, but if you can make it cheaper, just make the old one, please. 80s car plus airbags with the fuel economy, if you could. Like, and even with computers, the computers get more and more processing power. They get more and more hard drive space. They get better and better CPU. And what do? They make more and more complicated programs, more and more complicated OSs. We have the technology to make the old ones. I guess the solution to that one is get Linux on a Raspberry Pi. I guess for that it does exist. But why doesn't that exist for cars? Why doesn't that exist for, like, why can't I get a little, like, 250 square foot? They do have tiny homes. But I would say that they're not widely available. Where's the upside to the consumer of all this economic innovation if they're just like, here's a better product? I don't want a better product. I want a cheaper product.
Capitalism, right? That the people with the money see an opportunity to make more money than they otherwise might make. And so there's no incentive to create a lower cost option when they have the facilities to make an option that would make them more money. Because part of the issue for what you're talking about for having a like a lower tech car is that there's only so many car factories around, right? And if those car factories are tooled with like robots or really expensive manufacturing processes to make highly advanced cars, then downgrading to a cheaper version would cost them more money that on the table, right? If they've put up a huge upfront investment, billions of dollars to build these factories, who can compete, right? Only the other car companies. And so if they want to stay competitive and still make money, they have to make cars that sell at a certain amount to even get a return on their investment. I'm not sure you've noticed, I've noticed, that companies always have to like make more and more money, right? Every quarter, they have to show a higher return. If they go backwards, right? If they just coast along at just good enough returns, they're losing, right? That part of one of the fundamental flaws, not flaws, one of the trade-offs of capitalism is that you always have to have a higher rate of return over time. And for that to happen, you have to come up with innovative ways to market. You have to outcompete your competitors. You have to show a value add, right? You have to be like, my car is not just good, it's the best in this thing or that thing or this other thing. And to do that, it becomes more expensive, right? Because you're adding more highly sophisticated, state-of-the-art technology. And that's the way that goes for cars anyways. Because cars aren't just like one technology. They're a hodgepodge of 1,000 different technologies all clumped together, right? Because it's not just like the frame and the vehicle and the tires. Every little aspect of it is fine-tuned and highly invented and changed over and over and over and over again. Think of the intermittent windshield wiper. Initially, it was just a thing that goes back and forth, but then you add on different sizes, different speeds, different materials. You add on things like heating the window to clear ice and all sorts of add-ons, and each one of those add-ons costs more money because you got to pay everybody along the every step of the way, right? You got to pay like the original idea, then every innovation to the idea, and it just goes on, and it just starts to add up. Would it be great if this goes back to things the government could do for sure, right? Why can't we just have a government factory that makes your standard "I need to drive so I can live" car? Right? Because in America, at least, if in certain parts of the country, if you don't have a car, you are stuck. There's no buses, there's no trains, you're not going to get a plane to travel however long. U.S. is a big country, and if you want to get anywhere, you actually need a car. And so if the barrier to entry for a car is 3 times the prevailing minimum wage just to get like the starter car, okay. How's anybody going to do anything? I guess if you're rich enough, or if it's like a family car, if everybody pools their resources to have just one car, but not everybody has that kind of support network to rely on. So we create this weird schism, the strata of society of those who have cars and those who don't. And those who don't are left to the whims of, oh, maybe we'll throw in a public sidewalk here and there. Maybe we'll have a public bus, or maybe we'll have a train, maybe. And that's why you see a lot of people congregate into like cities and urban environments if they want jobs, because the cities have the infrastructure set up for public transportation. Living in the countryside or living in rural areas is a huge risk. You need a car just to get anywhere. And that's why they have a struggle, like, attracting people to work in some of these rural areas, like doctors and dentists, veterinarians. Because it's like, when you're just starting out, after you've gone through, what, 8 years of schooling, and you've got $500,000 in debt, do you really have a car just lying around to drive around for these jobs that pay less because they happen to be remote? No. And yeah, this goes back to that thing that this is where the government could be the car creator of last resort. I went through the list of things that Unicor makes, the correctional prison labor, and they make all sorts of unique stuff. They make signs, they can make glasses, eyeglasses, and all sorts of other things. Like, the government knows how to make things that are low cost, at scale, specialized, unique. And I think the reason for why they're not making your low cost, basic, meets all the minimum safety requirements, emissions, and all that car is because of lobbying, right? That car manufacturers don't want to compete with a much lower cost option, because why would I buy a $100,000 truck or van or car or whatever new when I could buy the $10,000 bare bones, will it get me from point A to point B without dying option? Because I know the choice I'd make. I'm very frugal. If I had an option that I didn't have to take out a lifetime of debt and leasing or whatever just to afford to drive it, and the insurance costs would be way lower, right? Like, insuring a car, I would assume, insuring a car that's much less expensive would be lower, because the insurance is based in part off of the value, at least my understanding.
There might be a small exception if it was so old that it was unsafe or something, but I don't. I think they all have to be safe. They all have to be safe.
Yeah, all cars to even drive have to meet minimum requirements, right? Like, they have to meet certain safety standards, tire, whatever, and you have to submit your car for emissions and oil change. It's a whole thing. But the point I'm trying to make is, with all the good things that could exist, cheaper housing, cheaper cars, cheaper everything, cheaper healthcare, computers, right? Technically, the government could do it, right? Because they can operate at extreme losses and still make things, but they don't do it because there's a financial incentive on the part of the companies in the private market to not have a cheaper option, period, so that they can have people buy their stuff. So the quintessential example, actually, is the electric rail car, is the streetcars all across the country that were bought up by, I think it was either tire companies or car companies, one of the two, where...
I heard it was tire.
Yeah, where essentially what happened was that cities had these public transportation that was super cheap. It was electric, right? Didn't rely on gas at all, oil at all, and available for plenty of people. There was a real effort by the private market to just put the kibosh on that, right? We can't have nice things because those nice things cut into the profit margin of companies that stood to benefit, tires and cars. And so the point there I'm making is that there are private market forces that not conspire, that's not necessarily the word, but that exercise their power in such a way as to ensure that they have a market for their products. Right. The best way to ensure a market for your goods is to be the only option. Right. And the way you do that is you make it so prohibitively expensive to enter the market at the bottom end. And then you, if there's forces that are competing against you in the market, you use your power and your resources to make sure that they don't become the norm. So that's why I mentioned the electric cars. That it took a very long time for us to get to the point we're at now, where electric cars are more ubiquitous. Because there was a time that there were electric cars, they were just niche and like kept locked in a drawer pretty much, right? Like, they'd get invented, but then the technology wasn't sold, that the cars weren't actually made. Actually, I think about that for housing, right? If you wanted to buy a plot of land and build like the lowest up to code housing, it would still be very expensive to get all the materials, to put it all together, to hook up the water, electricity, to meet the minimum specifications for walls, doors, roofs, all of that stuff. And for all those things, right, like, I get why they exist, why the code is written the way it is for quality of life and higher standards and safety, etc. But in effect, what that does is it creates a very high barrier to entry for anyone wanting to even live in a home that they own, right? If you wanted to just build your own home, the costs are actually pretty steep compared to other countries, put that way. The worry I have in those circumstances is that if there was any lobbying to ensure that the code requirements were higher than they otherwise might have been, in order to ensure that the only ones who make money are those who can afford the capital costs to build homes in the first place, like big developers, big construction companies, things like that, where in order to ensure they have a market, they essentially freeze people out of the market entirely unless you're already very rich.
I feel like getting a sign, holding it up and down, and it says, "We want cheap stuff." And you were saying you didn't want to say they conspired, but a smart guy said, like, when you're a big enterprise, it's not necessary to explicitly conspire to act both in accordance with your interests and to calculate what the other company's interests are and to do a game theory thing.
Yeah, so conspire, I guess, implies, like, malice. And it's not necessarily malice. It's just capital. It's just like market forces made it so.
Profit malice.
Exactly. Like, it's not necessarily malice so much as if provided the opportunity legally, right? Totally above board, ethically, fair, whatever.
It's what the system is set up to do.
Yeah, to spend your money in such a way that you can make more money by outcompeting your opponents in the market in certain ways, then. If everybody is on that same playing field, acting in similar ways, they're not doing it because they agree with each other. They're doing it because they have to in order to compete and make money. But the end result of that, or at least the side consequence of that, is that anybody who doesn't have enough money to even compete gets shoved out of the market entirely. And because we don't have a sort of third option of not competing at all, well, we do, right? So eco-communes, shared living communities, and prisons, like, they exist in their own little sphere of property values. Because the thing is, like, prisons are government, all of them are government subsidized, right? Even private prisons get paid by government. There's no, a private prison that isn't holding somebody who was found guilty of a crime through the criminal justice system is just kidnapping someone, right? Unless somebody's actually a prisoner, found guilty of a crime of the at the state, city, or federal level or whatever. Like, that's different. That's human trafficking. That's a whole separate thing. In that market, it's a little bit different, right? Because the incentive isn't how do I squeeze every last ounce of money out of the private buyers of prisons, because there aren't. It's how do I make it the most attractive option to the federal government to use my services. And the way you do that is you try to drive the price down across every metric you can of how much it actually costs to house a prisoner in that prison, which means that they do focus on, like, less expensive options in the sense of, like, smaller cells, smaller beds, higher density housing, like trying to figure out ways to get as many people as you possibly legally can while still being up to code in a space. And that is different, right? If that same approach was applied to just housing people to solve homelessness, sure, the housing would suck, right? Like, it would be small rooms with very little, a few amenities. But at a minimum, it would at least give people, like, a starting place. If your option's the sidewalk or this little room with a door and a bed and access to a kitchen and a bathroom, I'm sure there are plenty of people, given the option, we'd be like, I'll live in the little box, right? I'll live in the tiny house, or I'll live in the shared living space, because the street is a scary place. You're subject to the whims of society and the elements, all the dangers involved with that. But yeah, that it all goes back to there's no political will to do these things, because the powers that be, the moneyed interests, because they can lobby with not unlimited amounts of money, but a huge amount of money, they can significantly influence what actually shapes our reality in ways that may not necessarily be to the benefit of society as a whole. That the negative externalities of some of the profit-making centers of capitalism actually create a situation that leads to homelessness or leads to people who don't get access to medical care because they can't afford the high premiums for insurance, or it leads to people who have to walk instead of being able to drive because, lo and behold, they can't afford a car that costs like 10 times the minimum wage or some absurd number. The problem with that is the most people's wages are stagnant. They're stuck at the same wage growth and same wage amount for 30, 40 years. It's not as if everybody's rolling in money. Some are, right? Some sectors make a lot of money. Tech, some doctors, lawyers, some of the high-end professionals. CEOs are making huge piles of money. But not everyone's a CEO. Not everyone's a higher-end corporate executive. I always wonder who these car manufacturers are selling cars to if the pool of people who can actually afford their cars keeps getting whittled lower and the prices keep going higher and higher. Like, how are they ever turning a profit? That's what I don't get. Are people all banding together and chipping in 10 people for one car? That's what I've always wondered. Anytime I see the existing markets, who is their market? Who are they selling to? Maybe abroad, the middle class in China is as big as the whole population of the US, same with India. Maybe that's it, that it's a foreign market.
It seems to me that, like, post-World War II, like, the GI Bill and stuff, and you had cheap homes not available for everybody. At that point, there was a lot of disposable income, and then clothes were expensive, and they got cheaper. But that gradually, people... If I had an economic, I don't know, theorem, but we'll just call it an idea, it would be like this. People need food, people need housing, people need electricity, people need health care. Therefore, people aren't going to stop buying it unless they run out of money. Therefore, as a default operation, those necessities will take up more and more of the income. To a degree, a car, as you've said, is a necessity, so that would fall under the sort of way I sort it of... But maybe it doesn't have to be, because, like you said, because people can lobby, so the tire companies can lobby for there not being streetcars, because that's the profitable thing to do. And I think that what the people should do is make it no longer the profitable thing to do. But that involves, like, public consciousness and caring about, hey, can you imagine how cool a city would be to live in if they had cable cars running everywhere? It'd be like, hey, I'll just hop on the old cable car with my top hat on. I'm fresh out of World War II or something like that. That'd be awesome. I'd love that. And yeah, let's go with cable cars. Yeah, but who knows how to make all that happen.
They did know, right? They were making it happen, and then it got stopped, right? That's the thing. Some cities still have those cable cars, but no, they had a whole plan, right? There were cities and towns that were like, yeah, we're going to make cable cars that are extremely inexpensive to operate and run. And then that just stopped.
And now we got the bus.
Yeah. We know that there are alternative options, but all those options right now for products exist in prison. They're prison products and niche areas where they make stuff that's much less expensive and still effective. But it's just not available to the general public usually. Like, it's all internal stuff that they're making for the government. And it's like, the government knows how to make things because they make things. So why can't they make your lowest option car, your lowest option house, your lowest option bike, right? Like, why are we... I know the answer. It's so that private companies can make more of a profit and private companies lobby Congress, and Congress would be the one that appropriates the money to do this, right? They would be the ones that appropriate the money to actually build all the infrastructure and the factories and all that other stuff to make it actually happen. And there's a real incentive on the part of Congress to quite literally do nothing. We saw this during the shutdown, to just sit back and coast, right? To just not even do anything. Because if you just sit back and don't do anything, right? If government's not actually trying to make the situation better, then the people who profit off of the situation being worse profit more, right? It's supply and demand. Demand increases if the supply is limited, or if the situation gets worse and worse, that people turn to whoever's offering them the best deal or whatever. So There's always winners and losers, for example, in the economy when bad things happen. So when air travel, for example, the flights were being canceled, guess who was making, I'm sure, money hand over fist? Rental car companies. People were like, I have to get to a place in 2 days and I wanted to rent a car, but all the cars were rented out. It was like, wait a second, if all the cars were rented out, then that means that the rental car company just made all the money that they were going to make, right, for the day, because they make money based off of volume of just everybody. If everybody rents out their cars and they have no more cars available, they've made as much money as they were going to make that day. In that sense, there's always going to be these trade-offs of winners and losers and those who benefit and those who don't. But at the end of the day, the ones who suffer the most are those on the lower end of the income distribution, because they don't get access to even like the most basic of goods and necessities for housing, cars, healthcare, food. And that sucks, right? That we should have, I really wish there was a like default option of just like the most basic level of entry for these things, because that way at least people would have somewhere to start. Because right now you either make enough to go way up the ladder or you're stuck. The problem there is that the minimum wage in the country is, I think the federal minimum wage is still $7.25 an hour. It hasn't gone up in 15 years, 20 years. Like, it's low. It's really low.
Where can you even live on that amount of money?
I'm not sure. I don't know.
The Dakotas?
Yeah, I don't. I think the minimum wage creates a floor, right, from which higher wages can be commanded. And so if the minimum wage was increased, this is my gripe with all those people who are making more money at higher wages. They're like, if you lift the minimum wage, I'll be paid less because the lower wage workers are getting paid more. If the minimum wage is higher, then to be competitive, all the other employers have to offer even more money, because otherwise you would just go to the job that pays the higher minimum wage, right? Like, in order to pay more money for jobs that are paid more than a minimum wage, they have to be more competitive. They have to offer a better incentive. That's my gripe there, is that they haven't raised the minimum wage in years. That would be an easy response to some of the problems we have now. If it was commensurate with productivity, it'd be triple, right? Like,
And speaking of higher wages benefiting areas, I saw a video this week about when a Costco comes to town, they offer pretty good wages for somebody without a college degree. So the other businesses nearby have to themselves offer a higher wage if they want to. And you might think Costco sells cheap stuff, so are they going to have a bad effect on other businesses? Not according to the video, which I'll put on the website, because they do cheap stuff, but then they pay the people well because they can buy in bulk. But then that allows other businesses nearby to focus on higher value offerings. So maybe that could go to the like Unicor Model T production line. If those cars are rolling off and people can go get a job with their Model T, it's not literal Model T, but like Model T V2, version 2025. If people can go get a job with the cheap car, maybe they can afford the sports car a little bit sooner.
I was reading that Costco makes most of their money not from selling stuff. They make it from the membership fees. So that's how their business model works, is that you provide a good value, a wide assortment of goods, but the trade-off of that is to access the good value and the wide assortment of goods, you need to pay the membership fee. I get that. I understand why that model works the way it does.
Yeah, and you got to buy in bulk, so it really helps if you have a garage. And then the HOA says, you got to keep your car in the garage, not your stuff. And then I say, the garage is barely big enough for my car. I think I am going to put my stuff in there. And if you find me, it was cheaper than a storage unit, and they haven't fined me.
Yeah. So that's actually one of those other things when you're talking about why is life so more expensive when you're poor, is that if you don't have a car that can carry bulk goods and you can't afford the membership fee at Costco, then you're left with the options that aren't Costco, which is like corner stores, grocery stores, other options that maybe charge a higher premium on their goods, because they don't offer the value add of what Costco does with the bulk purchases. At the end of the day, people may actually be paying way more money on a week by week basis than if they could just buy in bulk. It's a basic question. If you're priced out of the car market, if you don't have access to bulk transportation options, by not having a cheaper option for getting to places and transporting goods, then you're subject to transporting your stuff by Uber or bus or renting out a car. And that's that can become prohibitively expensive too. So yeah, that's just, but also what you're mentioning for storing stuff in a house. Say you do buy stuff in bulk. If you live in a smaller apartment or if you have less space overall, or if you have roommates, then you can't buy a whole bunch of stuff that's non-perishable and just keep it there for a rainy day. Like you have to keep going out and buying the more expensive, more perishable stuff just because of the function of like less storage space. It all adds together to making life way more expensive in some ways for those who are at the lower end of the income distribution because they're priced out of the cheaper, more affordable options just by virtue of not being able to afford a car or more space, which sucks. The reason there aren't these lower cost options is, again, there's no real market incentive to do it, right? Like the upfront cost of creating these things is so high that to get a return, you have to make things at a certain level or you're not going to make money. I wonder if there's a nonprofit option for this. There could be, right? If somebody doing it like a charity, Habitat for Humanity is the example I think of for housing, of the sweat equity where they get contributions and then they build houses with the materials and all that. And you contribute to the building of the house and eventually you get to own the house. Like that's a model that I guess could work. Maybe, what if there was like Cars for Humanity? You help build a car and you get to, at the end of it, own a car. I don't know how that would get made, but I don't know if that even exists. That would be cool if that did exist.
It would. And you can get I think that it would require first a group of people with automotive experience. Because I see a lot of cars, maybe not a lot, but every like week or two, I see a car driving by with what is clearly some kind of souped-up go-kart engine because of the noise that it makes. I think it would require some experimentation, but I think that people are already doing something like that, and if you could apply that to helping the destitute, that would be a good thing. Just thoughts.
Oh, I just want a low car or low cost electric car option that you can power with a bicycle, right?
Well, hey,
how you encourage people to exercise, you hook up a bicycle to charge their car so they don't have to pay gas anymore.
I know. I loved that episode of Black Mirror where they were riding on the bicycles in order to generate electricity. It's like, what a great use of their time. And then they get to play video games while they do it. Yeah, why not? Bike battery. That's a good one. Mike's bike battery.
No, it's not. No, it's not mine. I think it already exists, but maybe the low-cost electric car option with a long-lasting battery. Because right now, if you get an electric car, especially for the higher ends, you have to go to either their charging stations or you have to power it up through an outlet or something.
Yeah, some of them you can plug in at home, but it's way slower. And so I like the plug-in hybrids right now because you can plug it in like at home. I don't have one, but you can plug it in at home, then you get gas if you need it, and you just save a little bit on gas. Of course, it would be a lot cheaper to just have an electric car. Mondays with Mike.